As a historical concept, genocide is a term defined as distinctly modern, connected in particular to the Holocaust perpetrated in the 1930s and the 1940s. How then can we consider genocide in the context of Game of Thrones, a television series set in a neo-medieval world? To answer that question, I speak with Dr. Julie Gilmore. Dr. Gilmore is an independent scholar whose work focuses on immigration, international relations, and Canadian history. Her highly praised book, Trouble on Main Street, Mackenzie King, Reason, Race, and the 1907 Vancouver Riots, published in 2014, is a history of anti-Asian policy and popular anti-Asian attitudes in Canada. In our conversation today, we explore the development of genocide as a legal concept derived from the Holocaust, how its components might be applied to events on Game of Thrones, and consider the power of history to help us think about our present. Thank you so much, Julie, for agreeing to meet with me today and to talk about the topic of genocide in Game of Thrones. I do think this is a topic for which we need a modern historian's perspective, so I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's awesome for me to be here. I have been thinking about things in new ways this week just because of this meeting, so thank you.
This is great. Well, let's start with the basics. I think if we're going to talk about genocide, we need to define it. How would we define genocide? What are some of the specific components that characterize a genocide?
It's the question I've been thinking about this week. It was coined in a book in 1944 by a Jewish Pole by the name of Raphael Lemkin. And he was writing about the Axis occupation of Germany. He had a famous book called The Axis Occupation of Germany. And he kept bumping up against this problem, which is Germany could do whatever it wanted within its borders. There was no crime to charge them with. And so he escapes and he goes to the United States and he spends time agitating for a legal term that not just scholars, but jurists can use to prosecute crimes against humanity in a way that had never been done before. So you have lots of experience with war, and there were all sorts of techniques people used that were just considered on the table and horrible, at least valid approaches to fighting an enemy. But in 1944, people had experience where this was no longer possible. They couldn't conceive of a world where it was possible to do this kind of thing to a group of people. So he was a linguist and a jurist and a scholar, and he decided that the only way to really fight this phenomenon was to name it. So he famously mixes a Latin and a Greek term and creates the term genocide. So it's firmly embedded in the Holocaust experience, which causes complications when one uses the term to talk about anything else in general, let alone medieval crimes. So there's one question. Right. The best document, if anyone wants to look at what we generally consider the legal framework for genocide, is the 1948 UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. So the first two or three clauses of the convention are key to understanding how scholars are going to define genocide and how the UN will think of it, and therefore the legal framework for prosecuting and dealing with it. So the first thing is that it can happen during wartime or peacetime. It's not necessarily a wartime event, and war doesn't make it.
Those two sound really important, because I think some people would assume that genocide has to be connected to war.
Not so. The genocidal policies against the Jews began in the 30s before the war began, right? Confiscation of property, prevention, labor, agitating against Jewish people. This is all in the 30s before the war started. Yep. This is already a problem. But the second clause has many parts, and these are really the actions that make up the crime of genocide, clause two. So A is killing members of a group. It doesn't define what kind of group. It doesn't have to be a religious group. It doesn't have to be an ethnic group. Killing
members. It's just a group.
An identifiable group. B, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of a group. So it's their identification as members of a group and therefore targeting them for harm, genocidal, right? C is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about the physical destruction in whole or in part. So one, it has to be deliberate. There's a lot of trying to prove smoking gun that it was planned, right? It's policies that affect this one group. And the idea is that to get rid of them or even partially get rid of them just because they're members of the group. So these are all things that people will debate, but it wasn't deliberate, but it wasn't aimed at a group. It was incomplete. It wasn't meant to rid of them all. Okay. D imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group.
So eradicating the next generation.
Right. So anything like raping so that the babies are not of that group, forced sterilization, killing the women, these sort of things, right? E is forcibly transferring children of the group to another. So like the residential schools, classic example. It was before the term was coined. So calling it a genocide is more of a scholarly action. So that's E. So those are the five things. The key is belonging to a group and being targeted and with the idea of getting rid of this contagion.
This particular group.
And then the third thing that's important about the Genocide Convention is you can be charged to commit a genocide, conspiracy to commit a genocide, incitement to genocide if it's direct and public, an attempt to commit a genocide. So if you're bad at it, it still counts. And complicity in a genocide, being a bystander. It's not quite a bystander. If you sell the machetes to a Rwandan warlord, you didn't kill the people, but
you were complicit in it. So the key components are membership in a particular group, that group being targeted in various ways, and then the actions that the people who committed the genocide engaged in, which aren't necessarily directly causing that genocide.
Any policy that leads to their harm, mental or physical. So preventing people from doing their job, making them sit at the back of the bus.
And so this definition of genocide was created specifically in response to the Holocaust and was created in a legal framework with aim of prosecuting people for these crimes. So how does it come to be used beyond that legal framework? You mentioned that there's also more of a scholarly argument or another way that genocide is viewed. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Right. So it's a really handy term. And one of the impulses coming out of 1948, when we now have this convention, is to prevent genocide. So a huge group of scholars start studying genocides in order to figure out what the red flags are in advance, what the best actions and policies are to prevent a genocide, when and how states should intervene.
So it becomes not just a legalistic term, but a term of policy as well as in other frameworks as a way of grappling with the potential of this happening, but also the fact that it may have happened in other contexts too.
And describing other events, describing what happens in Rwanda, describing what happens in Yugoslavia. People use it as a historical theoretical framework to draw parallels or to point out differences with the Holocaust. Of course, this is problematic because there are people who are protective of the Holocaust as a special genocide.
And so want that term to be employed only in that particular context.
But it's useful and it's interesting. Yeah. And it gets us thinking about the state violence and what's acceptable levels or behaviors for a state to protect its people, and when does it become a rogue state?
So using those components and those definitions, how can we think about events like in Game of Thrones as a genocide? You and I brought this up in conversation, and then I was like, that's really interesting to think about, right? How do we think about genocide? So I went and did some research, and this is a pretty debated topic into the context of Game of Thrones. So how can we think about these components in terms of Game of Thrones?
You know more about Game of Thrones than I do. So you tell me what people are interested. I have my own instincts. I just out of my own watching of the show and I was like, okay, there's the whole Daenerys scenario, but there's also the whole White Walker scenario. Like we are taught from the very beginning that the White Walkers are this scourge that needs to be removed or everyone is going to die. We believe that they're terrifying and they are, but it's very much a discourse of an other, right? I don't know what Game of Thrones scholars are saying, but for me, both of those things raise some of the same questions, right? Like creating othering groups that are close to us, but also groups that are far from us.
So do you want to expand a little bit? Can you talk about the White Walkers in the context of thinking about genocide?
Well, one of the things that is central to the ability to commit a genocide is a process of creating the idea that your enemy is less than human, that your enemy is not an equal, it's not an equal battle. So you want to get rid of them completely. There's no room for negotiation. There's no room for a treaty. There's no room for cohabitation in the space, right? You want to get rid of them. And in the first season, the number one object of this kind of discourse is the White Walkers. They're not human. They're beyond a boundary. They can't cross the boundary. People talk about them almost constantly, right? Winter is coming. Yes. And it's inevitable in that discourse that eventually there'll be a huge confrontation. There's no not having a confrontation with them. So that's a starting point for me for talking about the White Walkers and genocide, right? They are the most obvious other. There's othering between groups, between Winterfell and the people who ride the boats and the Dothraki.
Yeah.
But I feel like you can't ignore the White Walkers since they're there for the whole.
And the rhetoric through the whole show is that they have to be exterminated. The only means by which they talk about dealing with them is through extermination. And that if they aren't exterminated, then the rest of them will be exterminated.
And not only do they need to be exterminated, but if you don't, the whole human race will be infected.
Yes, that's a good point.
There's this medical / spiritual / moral panic about them. And this is the way people talked about Jews and in Germany in the 30s, the cancer that has to be excised from the body.
And the idea of contagion, I mean, that's a common language that's used in terms of thinking about others going back to the medieval period. In the work that Alexandra and I do on the Jewish community in Girona, you certainly see rhetoric of that, right? That this contagion must be exterminated so that it doesn't spread.
This is why I think it's really fascinating to be thinking about different times and different places, because this isn't new and it's not surprising when we see it as historians. It's a new context, and that's where the interesting work happens, is seeing how it's different. But there are times when we expect to see this. Economic difficulties, incomers, cultural differences, lack of international confidence in the state, uncertainty. And I think this is why it's so helpful to use a term like genocide to look at these things, but also to understand that it's got its own framework.
And all of those things are present in the Game of Thrones world when the White Walkers show up. There's all of these human conflicts that are happening because of the War of the Five Kings. There's climate change. So all of these things are very modern things that are set in a medieval world. So using this genocidal rhetoric makes sense in that particular context, but I think it's not something that people necessarily think about. This is one thing we found a lot in this course, is that as we push and pull and look through all the details of things that are going on in the show, there's all these things that didn't occur to us that make sense in the context of thinking about this show, right? And because the way we've looked at the show is through the lens of medievalism, which is looking at how the Middle Ages is represented in popular culture and thinking about how that representation is actually a commentary on our own society. So it makes sense to see these modern ideas being pulled in.
Yeah, this is the fascinating thing, right? Game of Thrones is a 21st century show that is written in the context of understanding this 20th century concept, being watched by 21st century people who in the basic way know that this is a crime. So it gives an opportunity to talk about these current ideas. And as you say, it's dressed up in these sort of medieval costumes. But I was curious to know from you, as a medievalist, how are you talking about the medieval? So mostly you're talking about how the medieval period is represented. So it's a current history of the medieval?
Kind of. One of the things that's fascinating about the way the show represents medieval history or medieval period is that Martin, in writing his books, and then Benioff and Weiss, who are the producers of the show and who wrote most of the episodes of the show, all of them claim that this is a more realistic representation of the medieval period than other shows because it's not Disneyfied. And so it represents the brutal, violent, misogynistic nature of the medieval period. And so when people, for example, critiqued their glorifying of sexual violence in the show, their response was, that's what it's like in the medieval period. We're just being true to the medieval period. Or when people critique their lack of diversity, then they use the same thing. Medieval Europe was white, right? So that's what we're looking at, is why do people believe that this is what the medieval period was like? What's going on in those supposed representations, and how is it actually reflective of what we know of medieval history? Sexual violence was a part of women's lives in the medieval period. It's also a part of women's lives today. So it's not like every woman is being raped in the medieval period, but they seem to imply that this was the case. And so that's what we're looking at. How can this tell us about how people think about history? How can we think about how the broader public are engaging with medieval history, if they believe this is true, what's the impression that they're getting? But how is this really not all that much about medieval history, but much more about our contemporary world, what's going on in our world today?
That's interesting. You, in your questions that you sent me ahead of time, you asked me the question about Daenerys's madness. And I feel like that is an example of people misrepresenting genocide, saying that's how it really was.
Yeah.
And because madness is actually something we were trying to get away from in the genocide scholarship. Hannah Arendt is the most famous example of this. Her 1963 book talks about the banality of evil, right? It's not about someone who's gone mad. Hitler's not just a bad guy. He's surrounded by people who help him do this horrible thing. Mm-hmm. Sense people who make train schedules and build buildings and guard camps and watch the trains go by. So I think that's a similar thing. People have this idea that genocide's about some crazy person who goes off killing everybody. But when you look at the scholarship, it's more about the structures and the systems in place that just don't stop it.
And that's where that question was coming from, because some of the discussions that I read about what happened in the Bells episode about Daenerys' descent into madness, and they've said that's why she massacres these people is because she's gone crazy. And one article that I was reading said that her actions make her the most unhinged of all, the Targaryens are mad and she's the worst of all of them. She's the most unhinged of all of them. And there's a lot of people who are unhappy with the tack that Game of Thrones takes, but it's really problematic how it represents her massacre of all the people in King's Landing as being tied specifically because she cracked. And I think you're right. That becomes an excuse for them to explain away genocide and mass murder.
It was the most disappointing thing for me in a disappointing final season, final episodes. Like, Daenerys had been this powerful, outward-looking potential monarch. And then in the last season, she turns into this genocidal paragon. And it struck me as odd. But more importantly for scholarship, it's not how genocide happens. Having sociopaths is helpful, but it's not enough.
It was disappointing in a lot of ways because I don't think it fit with the story that they had been developing in terms of her character arc. But I think it does a disservice to thinking about the experiences of people who were affected by genocide. It emphasizes this as an act that was abnormal rather than highlighting that these were things that were carried out by normal everyday people.
And it removes the agency of individuals in the prevention of the next one. If it's because of a mad king, then you take the responsibility away from the people who turn away. And Elie Wiesel's comment about good people doing nothing is the most often cited one for this, for my period. But we need agency. We need to believe that there's something individuals can do to help prevent this kind of behavior. And I think taking away that power, saying it's about an individual, doesn't serve anyone. Not like we've managed to prevent a whole lot of suffering in the world, but we need tools. Years of believing that there's a difference between two tribes or between two religions or between people north and south of the border or people whose skin color is different or people who are scholars or people who work on factory floors. Like, anytime you're creating an underclass that is not afforded basic human level, you're preparing your society for an easy descent into this kind of behavior.
And if you've spent all this time othering those people and dehumanizing them, then making that next step into working toward exterminating them doesn't seem as such a leap.
Since we're doing Game of Thrones as an insight, even though it's completely unscholarly, I had this insight years ago playing Civ. Have you ever played Civ?
No, I haven't, but I bet my students have.
Or being the Mongols and crushing all my enemies before me and doing these huge military victories. And I'm not a violent person in my life. I'd like to think that I have a basic humanity. But when you're playing this game, the logical step is get rid of everyone on your landmass, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the best thing to do is just get rid of them. I don't want to negotiate with them. I don't want them trying to change my religion. I don't want them taking away my resources. I just want to control the space. And it becomes an imperative. And I thought, oh my God, this is exactly the kind of boardroom mentality as people are looking at maps and looking at this corridor and saying, we need a port and we want to control this border. And this population here is awkward, like, just move them. or just get rid of them. People need reminders to watch for this stuff. Anytime you're talking about borders and controlling movement across borders and treating groups differently as they cross them, you have to be, what are we doing here? Why are we implementing this policy? To what end? And what's the underlying assumption
that's being made behind it? That actually is a good segue into talking about the Dothraki. We've spent a significant amount of time talking about the Dothraki. And in one of our earlier podcasts, I spoke with Shyla Carroll, who's a scholar who works on medievalism in Game of Thrones specifically, and actually writes a lot about race. And one of the things that she and I spoke a lot about was the way that the Dothraki are presented on the show in this very Orientalist fashion. But also the Unsullied, right? Anyone from Essos is orientalized in this way. And that in particular, that the Dothraki are very othered, right? They're regardless of who's doing it. But that in the Battle of Winterfell, they're just kind of sent out against the White Walkers with no consideration of what's going to happen to them or concern. And in some ways, I think what happens to them can fit within this context of genocide. So can we think about what happens with the Dothraki in terms of these components?
The Dothraki, just one thought that occurred to me, which is a little bit of an aside, but since it came up in my head, I'm going to say.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Is how the Dothraki and the Unsullied are opposite sides of the same militarized masculine coin, right? The neutered Unsullied and the hyper-sexualized Dothraki are interestingly, I think, both hyper-masculine and military, but on different sides of the sex. It reminds me of how people talk about the Chinese and the Japanese as military powers and as masculine beings.
In that way. That's interesting because we did a whole class on masculinity and castration, actually. And we talked about the way that the Unsullied are castrated yet masculine in ways that other castrated men are not, like Varys and Theon.
They're exactly not the castrated advisor. What's his name? They're the opposite of Varys, right? Yeah. In fact, even going as far as to be love hero in it, right?
Yeah.
And Grey Worm is in a love story, right?
Yes.
Oh God, he's Grey Worm. So he's unsexualized. So genocide and Orientalism. Yeah. So these are all tropes, both super masculine and super feminized and dangerous. So the only thing that occurs to me immediately on the question of genocide is they're easy to sacrifice because they were hired on as materiel. This is all of Daenerys's wedding. It's utilitarian to have their army. And their army is just bodies to throw at the gates of Winterfell, basically.
Yeah.
So it's logical from a military standpoint. I'm not saying I know a whole lot about military tactics or anything, but it follows the logic of her developing an army that's going to take back the throne for herself. She's not culturally part of them.
No. And it's interesting when you look at the Battle of Winterfell. So the very last class we're doing is on warfare, and I'm interviewing someone who's a medieval military history person. So I'm interested to see his perspective on some of these specific battles. But in the Battle of Winterfell, you see the Dothraki go out, and then there's the Unsullied, and then they have the White Army is behind all of that, right? So these other two groups are, we can throw them at because this is their purpose. This is what they're going to do. And it's okay if we lose them, but we're going to leave our white warriors behind here just to protect them.
To be fair, this is not a new idea.
I mean, oh,
you throw the peasants at the walls and then you mop up after. But it's because of the trajectory of Game of Thrones, these groups are all racialized. They're all ethnos. And which is in itself interesting. There's not a whole lot of multiculturalism in Game of Thrones, you know?
No, it's a very white. And the fact that Westeros is so white, medieval Europe was not that white.
Leaving aside the whiteness, which is huge, just in general, every group is basically an island.
Yes.
The occasional Winterfell bride goes down to King's Landing, but there's not a lot of movement. It seems almost just like a production problem. Like they just created this idea of each of these groups, and it could have been done differently, I suppose, but it communicated to the viewer that these people were different. So they made them look different from each other.
One of the things that we've talked a lot about is Martin's inspiration. So Martin claims that when he wrote the books, he read as much medieval history as he could get a hold of. But of course, the books are started in the 1990s. So he's reading stuff that was written in the 70s, 60s and 70s, which now is really old and doesn't reflect medieval history at all. So the basis of this medieval world that he's created is founded on bad history to start with. And then now it's set in this modern world. So that creates all, so many more problems to it. So for us looking at it as historians, and then they're also pulling all these different ideas from all these different time periods that, so history is this mishmash that's set in this medieval world, but there's all these things that are not really medieval. My last question, because I want to spend a bit more time talking about what happens in that final season when Daenerys is flying over King's Landing and massacring people. One of the strengths of Martin's books, and is something that's embedded in the show as well, is that they take us through these multiple viewpoints of different events in a single episode. So during the assault on King's Landing, we have Daenerys' perspective and we have all these different perspectives about what's going on in that particular event. So as she's flying over the city on her dragon, destroying the city and massacring all the people in it, we become part of the crowd fleeing her, right? Alongside Arya, we get to run through the streets and we get to really connect with individual people who are being killed in the act or being affected in the act in this various ways. So how do you think that type of representation might help modern audiences understand the experience of genocide? And then can you think of any other examples of popular media that do something similar?
I think it's important for people to imagine themselves as the marginalized, because not everyone has that experience in their life, thank God. Mm-hmm. But some people are very familiar with this feeling, and a little empathy for that will go a long way. So I'm all for that. I suppose I could tell you my origin story, how I became a historian at all is very much from this kind of exposure to an individual's experience of the Holocaust. So for me, it was the diary of Anne. I probably was 9 or 10 when I read it, and I became obsessed with the question of what would it be like to have to hide, and would I do the right thing, and would I hide my friend in my attic? Would I break the rules that I'm a rule follower, right? But if they were unfair rules, would I break them and do the right thing? So art provides us an opportunity to experience these perspectives that can give us so much more empathy for the lived experience of people with different lives. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, I'm all, but again, if it's done in the context of someone going mad, it loses its power. Because we all think we're going to avoid the madman, right? Yeah. Recognizing it in our own laws and systems is just different, right?
That's a really good point. The Diary of Anne Frank was also a book that has had a significant impact on me as a young girl. And my copy of it was so dog-eared that it was falling apart. And Anne Frank's birthday is the same day as my sister's birthday. So I felt like I had this personal connection with her too. And so when I eventually went to Amsterdam and visited the house where she and her family hid, it had a major impact on me.
I went too.
I highly recommend it and to read her story, because I think it's really important. So are there other examples of modern media that do this?
This is my plug for biography. Yeah. One of the most maligned forms of history is personal biography. But I strongly feel that it's by providing the color of an individual's life and the barriers and the victories that they live through, that people connect to historical moments, right? Like a number's a number, but experience has this other power. I'm going to take a moment to address my captive audience. Yeah. No matter what kind of history you're writing, remember that at root, it's biographies.
That's a really good reminder, actually.
Remember other examples of yes. this in film?
Any example that you might have that you could share with us?
Examples of lived experience of genocide?
Yeah.
Hotel Rwanda.
That was one I was thinking about too.
Romeo Dallaire's autobiography is heartbreaking.
Yes, I've read it.
And so I think it's important for people to read the stories of people trying to prevent genocide and ethically and within it. I'm a big fan of his.
When I taught in the US in my world history class, we did a unit on the Rwandan genocide, and none of my students had ever heard of it in the United States. And so we watched Hotel Rwanda, and I turned the lights on, and there was a full minute of silence before any of them could actually speak. Many of them were crying and they were, how did we not know about this? How had we never learned about this? This was in 2007, so not that long after it had happened.
It was a great American failure, and I'm sure it wasn't on a whole lot of curricula.
Yes, I hope that class made an impact on them. I did have a student who came to me at the end of the entire course and said to me, so now what do I do? And I was, what do you mean? They're like, I know about all these injustices in the world. So now what do I do? You talk to people about them and you tell them and you share what you learned in my class. And then you act, right? If you see an injustice, you act yourself. And I think that's the power that history has, is the ability to show students about what happened in the past and get them to think about what that means for our present.
There's an essay written by Vaclav Havel in the 70s called Power to the Powerless. And I often turn to it when I feel hopeless, because he describes living under communism in Czechoslovakia. And literally the only thing you could do was to live your truth in your life and keep your head straight about what the truth was. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's a revolutionary act. And that itself brings change. And when the world feels like too much, when it looks eternal, like it will never change, when it looks like there's nothing one person can do. I remember the example he gives of a sign that a shopkeeper puts in the window that demonstrates his rejection of communism. And it was dangerous, and it was revolutionary, and it was one person. All we can do is change our mind.